Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Man, is it cold out today? It's freezing. It's so cold that it could freeze the balls off a brass monkey. And if you think that's body humor, you're wrong. I don't engage in references to bodily parts. It's a nautical term. So figure it out or look it up. Don't complain to me. The main thing is that it's so cold out that I have to build a fire. But you know what? I'm not going to throw any red meat on that fire today. It's already being done in Washington. The Democrats are already busy burning their Republican witches. And with all the screaming and political religious chant of media, is this real news? Or is it just more shrill herding of the cattle? Oh, the witches. I'm losing my appetite already because I'm not interested in witches. But in Chicago, every institution is collapsing around us. The mayor's office, criminal justice, courts, prosecutor's office, public education, rising crime. As the 2023 mayoral race formally begins in a few weeks, and as Mayor Wokefoot flails around, and business leaders are just too afraid of their own shadows to really help change things. And as the city and state decline under the weight of corruption and liberal left-wing policy, I keep hearing all the time, John, you can't say that, or you can't think that. Which brings me to the introduction of our guest today, Megyn Kelly. You know her, prominent journalist, TV personality. She has a regular feature that I just love. It's you can't say that or you can't think that. And who's not telling us that we can't think or say things? She mocks them all good-naturedly. You can't say woke. You can't mention racist birds. And you can't offend man-eating or woman-eating sharks. Megyn Kelly is the host of the Megyn Kelly Show. Yeah, I owe her. Many of you know she's had me on her show several times. And her incredibly kind retweets of my columns have truly helped launch my new life here at johncastnews.com. Thanks, Megyn. I won't forget it. Kelly worked here in Chicago for a time, starting out in journalism and the law. And today I'd like to know how the city was for her then and what she thinks of it now. Jeff Carlin, my co-host, is here as always, master of pie, befriender of the devil's familiar, in other words, cats, executive producer at WGN Radio. We're recording this during his showtime, so he's going to pop in and out. And if you like what you hear here, subscribe free to the podcast, wherever you get your podcasts, and to johncastnews.com, where it's always linked free. And if you know any businesses that would want to advertise on the Chicago Way, so Jeff can finally get paid, reach out to John at johncastnews.com. Email me. So where are you? As Nancy Pelosi, and I hope she's wearing robes with plenty of incense around her, burns those Republican witches in Washington, as Chicago collapses right before your eyes, as the mayor election begins, and I'm freezing my ass off on the porch because, well, that's what Jeff wanted. You're on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Hello.
There was a man who took a stand with pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun, he sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
As I said, Megyn Kelly is a journalist and host of The Megyn Kelly Show. Airs on Sirius XM. Every weekday at noon Eastern Standard Time. And she can be found at YouTube.com, Megyn Kelly, and wherever you get your podcast. If you want to follow her on social media, go to at Megyn Kelly, that's M-E-G-Y-N Kelly, on Twitter and at Facebook. So, Megyn Kelly, welcome to the Chicago Way.
I'm excited to be here with you, John. How's it going?
It's great. I did show prep, you know, because I usually don't do show prep. I looked up Megyn Kelly on the on Google, and I find that you spent some time here in Chicago, that you were overworked and underpaid as a hardworking lawyer, litigator. And I wondered how that was. And you were so exhausted one time you caught yourself daydreaming on the Kennedy. Now, if you daydream on the expressways, you're probably going to get shot in Chicago.
Wasn't quite that bad when I was there. All right. First of all, I'm honored you did homework. I take that as a real badge of honor. And second of all, yes, I lived in Chicago a couple of times. It's really the only place I've ever lived in my life other than the state of New York, until these past 3 months when I finally moved to Connecticut. So it was where I moved fresh out of law school, 1995, fresh-faced and very excited at the prospect of being a lawyer and a big city girl. I had grown up in small towns, a suburb of Syracuse, New York, and then a suburb of Albany, New York. And then I went back to Syracuse for college and back to Albany for law school. So it was teeny tiny, you know, provincial upbringing for the most part. And then I went out to Chicago. I had interviewed with this firm based in Texas, but when they made me the offer, they said, we'd love for you to join our Chicago office. I hadn't even considered Chicago. I went out there and was totally dazzled. I couldn't sleep at night with the excitement of picturing myself in that city. And the first couple of years I lived there, John, were two of the best of my life. I wasn't really underpaid. I was well paid for the time. I just was too overworked to really enjoy it. But I'll tell you that as long as I live, I will never forget the night I moved into my apartment building. It was basically the North Pier apartment tower. It was like, yeah, Lakeshore, and right by sort of, you know, steps away from where Oprah lived on Navy Pier.
Right.
And I looked out the one side and I had a view of Lake Michigan, and I looked out the other side and I had a view of the Chicago River and the beautiful bridges. And all I could think was, I've arrived. I have made it. Look at me, you know, young lawyer makes good. And it was just in that apartment, by the way, I thought I had arrived because I had a washer dryer, which was huge.
Indoor.
Literally, yeah.
You didn't have to go to the laundromat.
I had a crate, like two milk crates to sit on, a mattress to sleep on. And I think that was it. So anyway, that was the beginning of a wonderful relationship between me and the beautiful city of Chicago. One
in
of
those
the many
days,
reasons it bums me out what's happened to it.
In those days, you could look out your window and watch Stedman Graham walking Oprah's dogs, right?
I had my eyes peeled, but no such luck. I never saw him. I never saw her. And that was back in the day when I still loved Oprah.
So
that's changed too.
Yeah, I liked her once too, but then I covered her, and it was different.
Mm-hmm.
They had the big goodbye to Oprah on Michigan Avenue. You know, they had the Daily shut down the whole street, and they had a big goodbye to Oprah.
Yep.
And before it got started, these poor women were waiting for the audience outside was waiting for hours and hours. So I got out there, you know, big-headed columnist, and I stood up on a chair and I, with a notepad in my hand, like I was official. In those days, I wore, you know, jacket and tie, and I said, "I have an announcement to make. I'm sorry, but the show has been canceled."
No.
Yeah, but I was just joking.
You were just messing with them.
Yeah.
They were in tears, I'm sure.
So what, you know, I just got to get to the Chicago thing first. This isn't the Chicago way after all. What have you noticed, or what do you think of Chicago and how it's, you know, I was just talking to a prominent longtime politician in town who told me he's not running for mayor. And he said, you know, every institution is collapsing. Every one, the schools, criminal justice, the courts, prosecutor's office, the mayor, she's lost it, you know. How do you see that from where you are? And
yeah, I do. I mean, I feel like for a long time, Chicago was able to stave off some of deep blue Illinois' craziness. You know, you had Mayor Daley there, ruled with an iron fist, and you could eat off the sidewalks when I lived in Chicago. I spent those 2 years there, and then I moved to New York for a couple years, and I moved back to Chicago for a few more years and moved a little north to Roscoe Village. But you could eat off the sidewalk. There was very little crime. The nonsense and insanity of Illinois politics stayed mostly outside of the city. And crime, I mean, it's not that crime was unheard of, but, you know, back when I was there, you had Cabrini Green was still around, and it was more centrally located in pockets. It wasn't widely dispersed. And trust me, I was young at the time. I was, you know, 25 to 30. So I was out a lot late at night on the streets, both in the Loop where I worked and, you know, downtown, and there you never had to worry. You didn't have to worry about anything. You know, like you wouldn't get mugged or attacked, or it wasn't a thing.
You didn't get stabbed. You didn't get stabbed if you didn't have $20 for the homeless guy.
No.
Right?
And you didn't even have to worry about, I mean, on Magnificent Mile, Michigan Avenue, you never had to worry about that. And now I do go back every year. Two of my best friends and I met when I was there, and one still lives there, and one lives in Detroit, and we meet every year, and we go to Chicago. So I was just back, and I was telling them about what you had been reporting to me, and they had noticed it themselves, my one friend who lives there in particular, and there were certain pockets you couldn't go to. It was like, I don't know, we don't want to go get a drink in the Loop, you know, just the three of us after 11.
Yeah.
We don't? Why not?
Right.
And you, all the stores, all the stores on Michigan Avenue closing down early, like closing at 6? I'm like, what? Since when does this happen, right? You want to get the post-work shoppers. No longer. Because they're worried about crime. So I could feel it just in that way personally, and it was a stark change.
What were the, what kind of legal work did you do? Because here's what I want to envision. This is my Megyn Kelly legal fantasy. Mm-hmm. You're like a kick-ass litigator, and you're like, no further questions, Your Honor. You know, one of those.
Yes.
And a lot of drama, juries, lunch at Gene and Giorgetti, you know, with your rival counsel. How did it go?
It was great. I mean, I loved practicing law when I lived in Chicago for the beginning, you know, and it was mostly like, oh, I don't know. I mean, we used to go to Smith and Walensky because I worked at 35 Wacker Drive and 55, the Leo Burnett building, and then the R.R. Donnelly building. And first was with Bickel and Brewer, and then was with Jones Day. And so I spent a lot of my time there. You know, we go over to, well, you know how that area is just great. There's many options.
Yeah.
And what's the one I'm thinking of? I'm trying to think of the Hard Rock Cafe.
Oh, yeah. Right.
But anyway, so yeah, I was getting way overpaid for, you know, my age level and my skill level, to be honest. I came from not much money. I graduated law school, $100,000 in debt. I had been working, teaching aerobics through law school to try to supplement my wallet. And then Bickel and Brewer started me at $85,000 a year, John. And I was like, I have made it like this. Yes, I can do whatever I want. I mean, to me, that was, might as well have had two extra zeros at the end of it. My budget would have been the same. I got a couch. I went in a Pottery Barn and thought, I can buy any couch in here. You know, like, this is huge. Mm. And that was all I needed in life, and I was happy with that. And I worked my tail off. I mean, back then, this is how old I am. I'm 51 now. I was 24 back then, 24, almost 25. We didn't have cell phones. We had to be contacted by beepers. So you had to have a 24/7 beeper on you, and your law firm would beep you if some emergency happened. You have to go in the middle of the night, which did happen. I mean, I lost a lot of weekends and a lot of holidays and missed a lot of weddings and so on because litigation at that level rarely sleeps, and I was a low woman on the totem pole. But I didn't care. I never complained. And it's one of the things that bothers me about the young people today. Maybe, I hope, not so much Gen Z, but certainly the millennials were, you know, full of complaints about their balance in life. And I was really kind of, my attitude is no one gives a damn, right? Get to work.
You said at one point in one of the stories I read in doing my show prep, and I'm just saying that again and again, so Jeff, when he's editing this, can laugh. But you said at one point, I think it was 85,000, you said, I'm making more than my parents made.
Yeah. Oh, by the time
I left. You didn't grow up silver spoon. There was no silver spoon in your life.
No, God, no. My dad was a professor at SUNY Albany, you know, so he made it fine living, nothing to write home about. And my mom was a nurse at the VA. And so, yeah, we were fine. It's not like we were, you know, wondering where our next meal was going to come from. But then my dad died suddenly when I was in high school. I was a sophomore in high school, and my brother and sister were in college. So now my mom, on a nurse's salary, and, you know, my dad was 45, John, so we didn't, he didn't have a big insurance policy. He didn't think he was going to die. And he just had a massive heart attack in 1985. So my mom had no money. My brother and sister really struggled to finish their college in terms of the finances. And something, I guess I don't want to say I have guilt over it because I've more than paid it back at this point. But for years, I labored with the guilt of the fact that my mom used my dad's entire insurance money to pay for my college education. And so I take care of her, you know, to this day. Yeah. But I just, if he had ever known that he was going to die so quickly and leave my mom with so many financial obligations, he would have been ashamed. And you can understand it because he was so young. But anyway, it was an inspiration to me to work hard and make sure that I could take care of myself. I could take care of my mom. I could take care of any family member that needed it. And that's why I never lamented late nights at the office in Chicago earning that money. I was happy for the opportunity.
That really sounds like a Chicago story because I can, you know, and Betty lost her dad. My wife, Betty, lost her dad when she was a sophomore in high school. And families come together. They do what they can. People work hard. They work their ass off. They play hard when they can. And they take care of business without complaints. You know, show up to work, show up early. And I figure that you took that attitude into the law. And also, you were an intern, weren't you? A news intern?
In Chicago. Oh, this is actually a fun story about Chicago. So there I was, and I was, by the time I got back to Chicago the second time, and this is, I had met my first husband. I'm now on husband number two, and he's the final.
Good luck.
But my first husband was a doctor, and he was training at Northwestern and so on. So he and I were living there, and you know, very much enjoying the city, but I was a little older in my law career, and I was starting to get burnt out. You know, it was starting to catch up with me. I had missed too many weddings and too many funerals and too many weekends and so on. I started to think, what else could I do after that moment on the Kennedy? Like, it was 2 or 3 in the morning, and I was like, what if I just, like, broke a femur? What if like, drove off to the side? Like, it'd have to be a femur, though. Like, it can't be, like, a wrist, because that won't get me time off. And I'm thinking, what am I saying? Like, perhaps a career change is in order. So what am I going to do now? Right? It's like most lawyers, I really only have this one skill set. And I started to think back to that high school aptitude test I had taken many moons earlier, which said I should be a journalist. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, that's exciting. You know, I could actually use a lot of the skills that I developed as a lawyer in that profession, but I don't know anybody. I have zero connections in journalism and, frankly, at that point in life, just none. And so I didn't know what to do. So I decided to take a guitar class in Chicago, which I did. I loved it. I took it weekly. And in the class, you never talked about anything other than, you know, the music. You don't talk about work. Everybody's right there to sort of escape. And one weekend, this woman named Meredith wasn't there. And she came back and I said, where were you last week? And she said, oh, I'm in news. And the space shuttle Columbia had blown up that prior weekend. And I said, oh, my goodness. And I said, can I buy you a cup of coffee? And she said, that sounds like somebody who's looking for career advice. And I said, I really am. So we did. And, you know, she was freelancing at WMAQ, the Chicago Ono. And long story short, she agreed to help me make a resume tape, or at least introduce me to this one guy. His name was Bond. He was their best cameraman, and see if he would help me make a resume tape and sort of help me get started. And she did. Bond got me connected with Columbia College.
Oh!
You know, Columbia.
Right.
And I went over there and started auditing a class about broadcast journalism. And there I was, the old lady. At this point, I was like 31, I guess. Yeah. Oh, but I was that old lady with the 19-year-olds out on South Michigan Avenue every night, every once a week, I should say, with my microphone. After Jones Day, I would sneak over there, take the class, and do a fake news report into this, you know, camera that wasn't really broadcasting anywhere.
Like a stand-up.
It was thrilling. Yes, but you couldn't start. You couldn't stop and start over.
Right.
It was like 60 seconds. You have to nail it. He'd give us the news story when we got to class, you know, like fire down wherever and four dead and blah, blah, blah. He'd have to run down there. It was so fun. I loved it.
I was at Columbia as well.
No way.
Yeah, way. I went there after I came back from overseas. I was in the Merchant Marine. A film teacher helped get me a scholar, like a kind of a help, you know, scholarship type of thing. And I was going to be a filmmaker. I was going to be, you know, doing like Fellini type movies in Chicago with sad clowns and violins. And actually, I just made a reference to them in a column, the sad clowns. So, and I was thinking of Columbia. But you know what? What I liked about it was there were pros that worked there. That taught there.
Yes.
And, so I'm,
Professor whose class I audited was Roger Schatz. He was amazing. And he was so kind to me, number one, and so helpful in terms of his coaching and helping me understand what worked and what didn't work and what a news story looks like and how to stay well organized and be concise. And he used to give these little awards out on these baking soda boxes. And it was basically, they were named after some girl who apparently came to the class one day and was so scared about being on air. She just hailed a taxi one day and he used to call them the Hey Taxi Awards. So you'd get, if you did well that week, he'd give you a Hey Taxi because you made it through another class without hailing a cab and running.
So let's go forward. You've had such an amazing and interesting career. The Fox News, all the crap you had to go through there, the Trump thing, where I remember writing a column that you had put the mark of death on his campaign, on his candidacy at that, on that night, and it didn't, I thought, you know, it was like the death touch, and it didn't work out. And now I see, you know, that you're doing this new thing, Megyn Kelly, the show and the podcast. But you still are interested in what's going on in the news. You're doing a lot of COVID, politics, everything every day. Mm-hmm. And the question is, how's the news changed? Because I think it's changed for the worse, which is why I'm an independent now. How do you think the news has changed?
Well, I agree with you 100%. I mean, when I entered news in the dark ages, I had one person I knew through a partner at Jones Day. A partner at Jones Day had a niece who worked at MSNBC. And she wasn't on air. She was, I can't remember what she was booking. Anyway, I remember contacting that person and saying, could you, you know, do something with this tape I've made? I would have worked at MSNBC. I didn't care. Then I met another guy Bill Salmon, who would go on to be the D.C. bureau chief, but wasn't at the time. He said, well, maybe you could send your tape to Fox. I said, sure, I'll send my tape to Fox. I didn't care. I didn't care about partisan politics. And those organizations were nowhere near as partisan as they are today, even Fox. It's crazy how partisanship has completely swallowed news and how I don't agree we're living in a post-factual world, but the news would certainly have you believe that. You know, they certainly do make you work for it way more than they used to. They made a decision to lean into their own bias, and it's made the consumption of truth really much more challenging.
I'm an opinion columnist. I have been. Everybody knows my opinion. I'm a South Side conservative guy. You know, I'm not coming off like I want to hang out in some New York salon and make witticisms, you know, with poets. But what bothers me is that the news coverage now in the news is limited. And you have this brilliant thing that you do. Things you can't say. Things you can't say. Mm-hmm. I love that. Because there are many things we can't say. Like, for example, when I worked at the Tribune, we could not say what was happening in Chicago with the fires and the looting. We couldn't call that a riot. We couldn't call it a riot.
Right. Well, that segment was born because of what was in the news. And I used to say I could write a column every day for a magazine or a newspaper called You Can't Say That. I expanded it to You Can't Say That or Do That or Think That. Oh, wait, this is America. Because the thought police are out in droves now. It's not just you can't say that. It's also you're not even allowed to think it. Or in some instances, you can't sit there and be silent like that, right? Like mandated speech is now all the rage. We need to hear from you.
You must stand up and demand that all the witches be burned in Washington for the January 6th. And as the funeral pyres rise and the flames rise, and we'll hear the Republican witches screaming. I mean, that's what it seems to me. And it's boring.
True. Oh, it's a great point. I was just saying today. So today's the anniversary of January 6th, and I am tired of what seems to be the understanding amongst most pundits that you must begin any commentary on January 6th with, there's no one who thinks it was worse than I do. I was one of the first to condemn it. It was horrible. It was a horrific stain on the leg. Okay. Just shut up and make your point. Why do they do that? Because they're afraid of getting attacked. They're afraid someone's going to write something about them, calling them a January 6th denier. Well, would you just grow a pair? Just say how you feel. You're not going to win these people over by saving your whatever's coming next after that, you know, until after the disclaimer. We do it all the time. I'm so tired of it. I was just saying this the other day about the schools, too. You know, I've become sort of a complainer at my kids' schools because I'm sick of the masks, and I'm sick of the damn plexiglass and all this. And I am no longer beginning my little emails with, first of all, so grateful to you for being open. No, I'm not. I realize Chicago, you're not open and it's a problem. But I don't have to thank the teachers or the heads of school every day for opening and showing. It's expected. It's part of the job. You show up, you're there. Right? Those should be condemned who don't show up, but those who do don't require a thank you every day. And I feel like we need to get to the place where we can be criticized, we can understand that's coming, whether it's something we say or something we don't.
Because they're afraid too. The parents are afraid too. That's why they want to protect, I better say something nice to this teacher so that she or he is, you know, nice to my child. Because getting them into an Ivy League school is everything, although you didn't go to an Ivy League school, neither did I. Mm-mm. And it's just the obsequiousness of the culture is enough to want me really just sit on the porch of a 3-flat, have a smoke, drink a beer, and just forget it. You know?
Yes, I know. But like I can see in you, and I have it too, just sort of a contrarian streak. Mm. And the more I see people doing that, the more I start leaning the other way. Not politically. I'm just saying, the more you tell me I can't say it, the more I want to. The more I see people kneeling and genuflecting on, you know, whatever issue of the day we have to treat as inviolate, the less I want to do that. And I think there's value in that, right? You can't go sit on the front porch of the three flat, because the millions of people out there who feel as you and I do, who don't have a microphone or a pen or a camera, they need us so that they know they're not insane. You know, they're not the only ones having the feelings.
So then tell me, as we get ready to close, why can't I say, what is a racist bird name anyway?
Oh,
what is and why can't I say shark attack?
Attack one was amazing. Wait, the racist bird name, I can remember that one.
It was Oriole.
Dinger. It was something like dinger. There was a problem with dinger. It was too close to some other word. The shark attack, that is a problem because sharks have feelings too, John. And they're not really attackers. They're really just people or things with whom you have a negative encounter. And if you feel the need to call it an attack, it's really because you've been biased by Hollywood and movies and TV shows. And if the shark happens to bite you, you should reconsider casting that as simply unwanted attention so as not to unfairly demonize the shark.
Okay, Jeff, please drop in Captain Quint talking about the Indianapolis right about now.
Very first light, Chief. Sharks come cruising. So we formed ourselves into tight groups. You know, it's kind of like old squares in a battle. Like you see in a calendar, like the Battle of Waterloo, and the idea was, shark comes the nearest man, that man, he start pounding and hollering and screaming. Sometimes the shark go away. Sometimes he wouldn't go away. Sometimes that shark, he looks right into you, right into your eyes. You know the thing about a shark? He's got lifeless eyes, black eyes, like a doll's eyes. When he comes at you, he doesn't seem to be living until he bites you. And those black eyes roll over white, and then, oh, then you hear that terrible high-pitched screaming. The ocean turns red, and in spite of all the pounding and the hollering, they all come in and they rip you to pieces.
It's amazing.
As we say goodbye to Megan. Megan, thanks so much. I, before we go, I just have one more thing.
Yeah.
I said it in the intro where I did all my Megan talk, but really, I've started this new thing, John Cass News. It was a big step for me to leave a paper that I once loved and no longer love. But your treatment of me and putting me and tweeting my column on that Kyle Rittenhouse thing or whatever you do, for a guy starting out in the business, it's huge. And I said this in the intro and I wanted to say it to your face. I'll never forget it. Thank you.
Oh my gosh. That is so sweet of you, John. You're a legend. Yes, I'd love to help you and see your new business grow, but it's out of love for your ideas and the way you write and the way you make me feel. That thing you get when you read John Cass and you think, oh, I want a column every day on every single subject that's important to me, because you've got the gift. The thing that makes your heart sing as a consumer when you hear the ideas swimming in your head that you haven't been able to articulate, right, you hear them said by John Cass, you read them written by John Cass, and you swoon. So I'm happy to do it just because it makes me happy. But if I can grow your platform in any way, shape, or form, I'm in.
You've done a great job already. And thank you, Megan Kelly. When you're back in Chicago, I hope you can spare just one luncheon at Gina Giorgetti where we can talk, look at all the old wise guys and politicians, if they still go there, you know?
I would love to. And then later that night, we've got to go to my old favorite hangout, the Hang Up. It looks like Hangy Uppy on the sign.
Yeah,
I spent a lot of time there, John. We will be like double and triple the ages of the people in that facility, but it's a good time.
Thanks, Megyn Kelly, for being here on the Chicago Way. Thank you
so much.
I'll
talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Megyn Kelly, for being on the Chicago Way today. And thanks again to Jeff Carlin, master of sound, lover of cats, executive producer at WGN Radio. He's busy with the day job, but if you want to advertise so the Chicago Way can pay him, say if you know somebody with a meat market, I'm just saying, or anybody else, email us at john@johncastnews.com. And for all of you out there who are seeing this city shudder with so many parents left in the lurch by the Chicago Teachers Union, with the institutions breaking, with the witches burning in Washington, and with Mayor Wokefoot back in Chicago doing what she can to salvage her career. It's going to be a fascinating year, and I'm glad you're with us on the Chicago Way on WGN+.